from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net podcast. My name is Jacob Fortant. Today we continue our Atheist Appreciation Month. And today my guest is someone who has been at this game forever. In terms of like internet atheism, he is one of the early guys. And I hope, although this, that most of you have heard of him, although I know that there's lots of you that have not, and this is why I'm having him come on the show, tell us more about himself, and to tell us more about what he does. His name is Austin Klein. He is the head writer for atheism.about.com. You've probably, odds are you've probably read his stuff, but you've never really put, you know, sort of like, I guess you probably never even had sort of like a story to go with the man. So with that in mind, I'd like to thank my guest, Austin Klein. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm enjoying it so far.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was quickly realized when I was trying to compile a list of who are the atheists that I think should, that we should be paying a little bit more attention to. And I remember, I'm, you know, going back, I'm like, how long have I been reading these articles written by this guy called Austin Klein?
Yeah, it has been a while.
Yeah, I don't think I really realized it until I went back. And you started writing in 1998, is that right?
Yes, I took over the site in May of 1998.
What exactly drove you, or what compelled you to actually start this?
I had actually started doing something similar on my own. I was just, you know, writing little articles for myself. I wasn't actually the first person to run the atheism site. It was run by someone named Vincent Wales, and he actually got it started with them. They had their religion channel with some Christianity sites and Islam and Judaism, and he made the case that they should have an atheist site because, you know, there are a lot of atheists out there. Even, you know, back in, I think it was 97 when he got them to get it started, and he wasn't able to continue. And someone at Internet Infidels, where I had an email address and, you know, chatted with people there, they saw that the position was open and knew that what I was doing, stuff that I was writing, and they thought it seemed like a good fit. Hey, he's kind of already doing what the people over there are looking for. At the time it was called Mining Company, not About.com. So they let me know that the position was open. I never even heard of the company, and I applied and went through the training and got the site. And I've been at it, as I said, since 1998. There aren't many guides there who have been there that long, in fact.
Well, I mean, I just have to wonder, in all that time, I mean, like beginning in 1998, I mean, this is still before we have a major recognizable atheist movement, if you want. So this is sort of like in the early parts of it. What were you writing about in those early days?
Oh, geez. I was doing a lot of separation of church and state, doing things about defining atheism and what atheism means and what atheists believe or don't believe. Even then, it was still a bit of a controversy, and there are arguments about it. And trying to find links to good information on places like Internet Infidels, because There weren't blogs didn't really exist at the time. I don't think they existed at all, come to think of it. I mean, there weren't, as you said, lots and lots and lots of sites out there of atheists presenting information to other atheists. So I spent a lot of time digging around for good information to offer people. And also sort of critiques of Christianity and Christian history, the religious right. There was still plenty of that to write about at the time.
And how did it work before in terms of people interacting? Did they send emails? Because it's not like there was just an easy comment section. Was there at the time?
No. As I said, I don't think blogs existed at all, much less comment features. There was a chat room, which they don't exist as very much anymore. There was a chat room, and I had some people volunteer to be chat moderators. We had forums. At a forum, it's changed software a couple of times. Fortunately, I've had several people through the years who have been very helpful being kind of assistant managers to keep an eye on things, control spam and trolls and that sort of thing. There have been a few people who have been a part of the community almost since the beginning, and they're still there writing and interacting with people.
Is it almost like its own tiny community because of the way that it developed? Like, do you have are there people that you sort of like regularly talk to that have been following you for that long? Like, do you have, is there like a core base of people that have just paid attention for that long? Because, you know, like this is starting to get, you know, especially now into an impressive amount of time, you know, like this is over a decade that you've been doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there are a core group of people who are in the forum, for example, who've been there for a long time, stick around. They've gotten very close. In fact, I think that there was one or maybe even two couples who have gotten married or at least gotten together in some fashion because of meeting on the forum. I've interacted with a couple of people who started out as Christians and deconverted because of spending a lot of time over the years on the site, and a few people have mentioned in comments about having been readers of the site for an extended period of time, though they don't, you know, email me constantly or anything. They're just kind of sort of passive readers, and I'm sure, I hope, that there are a bunch who keep coming back.
What exactly compelled you to start in the first place? Were you religious when you were younger? Or were you always a non-believer? Where did you begin your life as a non-believer?
Well, I grew up in a somewhat, well, not a very religious household, I guess. Somewhat religious. I made the choice on my own to regularly attend church when I was young. It was an American Baptist church, not Southern Baptist. And I kind of grew away from that. I still consider myself at least a theist, if not sort of vaguely liberally Christian. Then I started studying religion in college and more started falling away. The more religious studies courses, more philosophy courses I took, the less religious, less strong my beliefs grew, until eventually I can't remember when exactly it was, but I discovered Secular Humanism in Free Inquiry magazine. That really kind of turned things around for me because I started looking at it and thinking, you know, this actually describes where I am and what I think more than any religion ever has, or at least has for a long time. I think that the final break came for me when I started to realize that as various religious doctrines started to fall away and various dogmas, or I stopped believing, I realized that whenever I was trying to salvage some sort of belief in a God, I kept describing God in ways that sort of imitated things that I valued. I realized that God just happened to look like what I thought was good, like particularly, you know, a good teacher, a good professor, wise teacher sort of thing, and I realized, you know, this can't be a coincidence. This is all coming from me. This is not like I'm making an objective, empirical, detached description of something I'm observing. I'm just, you know, taking things that I value and ascribing them to the universe, and just saying that it has, that it is a being with consciousness and personality. And that just doesn't work. You know, you can't do that and say that you're being reasonable. So. And it was around that time that I discovered secular humanism and realized, you know, this is a little bit more reasonable to say that these are the things I value and trying to ascribe them to, instead of ascribing them to the universe, ascribe them to humanity and say we should stand up for these things.
I have to imagine, though, I mean, it must be what you do fairly thankless. I think you were telling me that every month you write something like 100,000 words or a ridiculous amount, like a third of a book a month or something like that. And you know, you said it before, I mean, you don't come from an environment which was really as interactive as even sort of like the blog world. So you're kind of like, you're a little bit stuck in the middle, in a sense, because you have this obligation, and obviously people that care and read it. And I think it's probably part of the necessary just amount of work and writing that needs to be done about it. You know, because there's tons of other guys on the other side trying to do the same thing, right? Just trying to inundate the internet with their nonsense, and we have to be somewhat of a panacea to that. But how do you manage in all that thanklessness to continue doing it? I mean, you've been doing it for as long as you have. I mean, what kind of like is in your mind when you write these articles? What are you trying to sort of like get through?
Well, I do come from an academic background, and I like to think that I'm informing people out there. I came to the realization a while ago that it doesn't really make a lot of sense to to make it my goal or my purpose to deconvert people to just, you know, I want to convert you to atheism. I want to make you an atheist. That doesn't really work. My goal is a bit more modest, and that's to try and plant a seed of doubt, to encourage people to look at things a little bit differently, to think a little bit more critically, a little bit more skeptically. And that, you know, more or less lies behind almost everything that I try to write. So because the goals are modest, I feel that the more I throw out there, the more that I can do, the wider range of things I can write about, the more likely it is that I will touch one person here, one person there, and hopefully it'll develop into something over the long term. But coming from an academic background, I'd like to read about things, and I want to let people know about things. I learn things that I find are interesting that I didn't know about, and the only way that I know how to deal with it is to turn around and write about it myself and to just try and put it out there and hope that over time some people will end up reading it.
What about the awards there that appear on your site? Did you come up with that? Is it an about.com thing? Or
actually, that originally was a project of a few guides on their own, and then the management of about.com looked at it and said, hey, this is a really good idea. We should, more of us should do it. So let's try and make it more official and centralized. So it is an about.com thing. I come up with the sort of general subject areas, like, you know, reader's favorite book or reader's favorite blog or reader's favorite podcast. Then there are nominations where people nominate what they want their favorite to be. I pick the top five or so acceptable, reasonable, decent choices, you know, as long as no one's trying to spam with their cheat by putting in, you know, trying to nominate the same 100 times all on their own, and then people vote for it. So it started out as a guide-initiated thing, I think the Autos channel or the Electronics channel, I can't remember which, and now a bunch of other guys are doing it as well, with About.com helping out in the background.
And do you have a lot of interaction with the atheist community, or are you pretty much kind of like doing your own thing?
I'm generally doing my own thing. I used to have a bit more interaction with the Center for Inquiry. I just have not had a chance to travel around and do very much. So pretty much everything you see on the site, unless someone else's name is attached to it, because others have written a few things for me, but pretty much everything is written by me, and everything is done by me on my own. Occasionally, with help from my wife, doing some proofreading or giving me suggestions, that sort of thing. I probably wouldn't be able to do as much as I am without her support, but as far as the actual direct work and writing, it's all me on my own.
I mean, I have to imagine that there is a kind of, you're currently working on some projects, that there must be, I don't know if I want to say an end game, but is there a sort of like something else that you'd like to transition from the project? Because one of the things that you mentioned that you were working on that you wanted us to talk about was this sort of timeline that you've started working on for various religions, right? I think I was reading the Scientology timeline one, where you just talk about different dates and what happened on all those dates. What's the idea behind that? Why a timeline, and kind of like how do you hope that people find it and interact with it?
It originally started out as something I was doing for About.com, which was just a straight plain page of dates of various events. It was going to focus on a couple different things. There's some timelines dealing with religious violence, like the Crusades, and things that churches did in the Holocaust. And then some, on the other hand, things that are more immediate interest to atheists and freethinkers, like history of church-state separation, history of skepticism, history of atheists. And so they were just, you know, kind of static, plain pages. I always wanted them to be more, and kind of fell away on About.com. I wasn't doing it so much, and I just wasn't able to do what I really wanted, which was an interactive timeline where a single event could easily appear on several different timelines, depending on what's going on. I had hoped to be able to do that with blogs because make an event in history a blog post and assign that the date, and then it'll appear in sort of blog format. You just have to do the sorting. Unfortunately, all the blog software and MySQL, they they don't allow old dates. I can't remember what the farthest back they go is, 1970s, 1960s, I think. Certainly not the Crusade era or ancient Greek or anything like that. So
before the internet existed, maybe?
Right, exactly. So it would be perfect, but I couldn't use it. And it really annoyed me. So I just put it on the back burner. And then I came across some software called JReviews, which goes on to Joomla, which basically puts an interactive, fully featured relational database around Joomla content. So I can't quite have the dates that I want, but I can fake it. So I can have every event with a day, a month, a year, and a bunch of tags. And with that, I can create dynamic lists of events associated with the person, associated with the Crusades in general, associated with the First Crusade or the Second Crusade, associated with Christian violence or Muslim violence, with anti-Semitism, whatever. So I can have dozens and dozens of these different timelines, and you get the event, you click on the event, you can read about it, you see other things there, so you can click on a person's name or religion or something and get other related information. And that's why it's pretty much what I always wanted to be able to do, but I wasn't able to do it until starting last year when I discovered the software. But it's a lot of work because I had a lot of these events in a database, actually. But for one thing, they all need titles, and they all need to make sure the dates are correct, and I need to proofread them, and I'm adding more dates. So we're looking at 600, 700, 800 dates per month that I need to prepare. That's where a lot of the 100,000 words is coming in. It's a lot of work to write this, and early next year I'll be sort of done with that in the sense that the bulk of it will be in. There will always be new things that I come across to add, but at least I'll have time for something else, because right now I'm, you know, except for about.com and writing for this timeline, I don't have time for anything else going on.
You don't have a life. That sounds kind of depressing.
Yeah, you know, I had been doing some other stuff last year, but until I found it. Unfortunately, it's difficult to get away from it, because if I want to have these dates available for July, I've got to be making sure that I'm writing them and getting them prepared 2 months previous, so that I can get them written so someone else can do the proofreading. And I don't want to skip it. It would be nice to skip a month, but I don't want to skip a month, because then there's a big hole in the calendar until I can get to it.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, you mentioned calendar. I feel like if you had like this whole timeline would be a really awesome interactive calendar that on any given day, like let's pretend I had an online calendar where I was just like, oh, today is June 24th, and well, it turns out that on that particular day, something horrible happened in history, and it was because of religion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I've got that. I've got today in history, and again, because I'm able to do custom database searches with this software, it automatically brings up all the events that I have so far for whatever today happens to be. Every day, it gets changed again. And I've got little calendar modules, so if you want to see what happened yesterday or the next day or sometime earlier or later in the month, you can click on it.
So this will be, I'm going to be able to put this in the notes, and people can go on there right now. Like, the database is already, what percentage did you say that you would finish?
Everything up through July. I'm doing it a month. Instead of doing it topically, like I'll do the Crusades now and the Holocaust next month, I'm doing it month by month. I started just after Thanksgiving of last year, starting to prepare January, and just a couple of days ago, I uploaded July. So January through July is up. So it's kind of strange in some ways, because there are lots and lots of events in the latter half of the year that aren't there yet. But this month's there. So if you want, whenever listeners happen to listen to this, if they go in and to the timeline and click on under the menu for timeline, it's Today in History. They'll have today stuff, whatever today happens to be for you right now. When you're listening.
It sounds like you're just still trying to lift the world up yourself. I don't think you should be afraid to put the word out there and to see if anybody's willing to help. I mean, especially, Austin, with the amount of time that you've put into this thing, I'm sure that there's lots of very talented people that have a specific talent that perhaps you lack that'd be willing to give you some help. Because I think that in throughout this, the reason that I wanted you on the show is because when I saw the numbers that you had of followers on Twitter and so on and so forth, I thought the numbers were too low considering the quality of what you put out there. And I think part of it is what I said before. I think that you're kind of like at that unfortunate, like I call it the horse whip of the internet. You know, like when I was working for Bell, I worked for dial-up internet. So all of my skills went into like the most useless thing ever. So you can get caught, you know, like you were caught right before blogs had it big. So in a sense, I mean, I feel like if there was more, if it was easier to identify all the work with you rather than with this larger site, then I think that you would have probably have gotten a lot more attention and definitely more respect thrown your way, considering how much you've done for the scene. Seriously.
Yeah, there are certainly advantages and disadvantages to being part of a larger company network like About.com. And on the one hand, they are able to promote me in ways that having a WordPress blog wouldn't be available for me. On the other hand, I do kind of, it's easier to get lost and not be seen.
Yeah, definitely. And I would say, too, that my big complaint that I have with About.com is it's hard to read. It's really hard to read. I feel like they just need to fucking redesign their site, because I feel like it's like the 2000s vomited all over it.
Yeah, there's certainly some legitimate complaints, concerns, criticisms about various aspects of the design. Unfortunately, they do have a lot of constraints as far as what they can and can't do, being a part of the New York Times and having to pay lots of people salaries when it comes to the advertising, make sure the advertising is in the right place. I can see lots of validity in criticisms. On the other hand, I also see it on the other side, knowing what sorts of constraints exist. So it's a catch-22.
Are there people in the scene, for instance, that you follow a lot, secretly just read their stuff, never really have communicated with them, but you just always thought, damn, that shit is good?
There are a few. I mean, I try to it's difficult to explain. I've got a NetNewsWire newsreader where I have a bunch of blogs in there, and some other sites, probably not as many as I should, but I try to just keep abreast of what people are talking about. I can't say that I visit any one site and read it really closely. It's a question of time. There's so many things to read and so little time to do it in, but there are a few sites that I try to at least keep my eye on to see what's going on, like Friendly Atheist and Ferengula and a few others, just so I know what's going on and make sure that I don't miss any important stories or developments, even if I'm not there right in the middle of things commenting on it.
Since you've been doing this, how have you, like, what is your observation of the way that the scene has changed? You know, it's like from the very, you know, from the beginnings of 1998 to how it is now, like, how have you observed that change? Like, what would you say are some of the patterns or some of the things that maybe people don't know since they've only sort of, like, been reading about this stuff for maybe a few years?
Interesting question. I hadn't really thought about that. Certainly, I guess one obvious change is that things have become a lot more conversational. So I'm thinking back to, you know, the big 800-pound gorilla mainstay of information for Atheists Online was internet infidels. You know, that if you wanted something, that's where you went. And the things that you found there, for the most part, tended to be more scholarly and academic in tone and presentation. Once blogs came out, then things became a lot more conversational, because you had just regular people just talking about what interested them. And, of course, something that comes along with that is a lot more passion for activism. You know, when you're writing a somewhat semi-scholarly academic paper on theology or church-state separation or some aspect of Christian history, it's not a call to arms. It's not trying to get people to write to someone or to make their own voices heard on something. Whereas with blogs, you've got that all the time. And as people have seen, a lot of the cases of it, that passion, that call to arms, that desire for activism has changed things for a lot of different people. So you definitely did not have that in 1998. And if you tried, you probably wouldn't have accomplished much because people weren't as engaged at the time. You didn't have the commenting systems. You didn't have the communities in the same way. So I would say the more personal, conversational tone, the passion, the activism has really increased since 1998.
Well, maybe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, because these are my own personal observations, but I always found that one of the major differences that you have with, let's say there's a conference where atheists gather and a conference where religious people gather, is that atheists are very, very enthusiastic to talk about their own observations, their own ideas, and so on and so forth. I found that in most conventions, in fact, everybody already knew what the speakers were going to say, but they just wanted to have their turn at the microphone. It wasn't even so much questions. It was pretty much comments on themselves. So I think that maybe, because you mentioned it before, like the ability for it to be more of like a commentary, more of a conversation, is that I don't think that anybody wants to be monologued at too much. You know, I think that we're probably used to that as a group that left religion, where it was just some guy in a pulpit telling you what to believe.
Well, certainly, and also so many atheists are isolated one way or another. Being able to go to a conference, even if you're not hearing anything new, but you're hearing it in person and you're talking to people. You're talking to people maybe that you only interacted with online. That's going to really energize people and it's going to excite them. And heck, just talking to other atheists live and in person for a lot of people, that's going to be a big deal. And I saw that even 98, 99, 2000, because there are just so many people who didn't have that sort of opportunity at home where they lived. In contrast, your average religious person has churches that they can go to. Most of them do go to church, and if they don't, it's probably more because they just don't feel like it. So they have plenty of opportunities for the personal interaction with people who have similar ideas. So conferences are really going to help atheists in that way, and I think that probably has made atheist blogs such a big thing because they're sitting there talking to other atheists, other free thinkers, people who have similar backgrounds in terms of questioning religion and similar experiences with family, so they can just commiserate a bit. Everyone needs that.
Do you think that as our movement has gained strength and notoriety, that we've caused a kind of a bit of a religious resurgence, a bit of a resurgence on the right as a kind of counter-reaction to our newfound confidence and power?
I suppose it's possible. I'd be hesitant to assert that too definitively without maybe some hard numbers. Because for one thing, the religious right, the hard religious right, they really don't need an excuse to be resurgent. You know, they'll latch on to almost anything that seems halfway vaguely threatening to what they believe and what they want. If it weren't the so-called new atheists, it would be something else. And also, the more I look into things, the more clear it becomes that everything that's allegedly new isn't really new. All the complaints about new atheists and new atheism almost pale in comparison to the sorts of things that were being said about secular humanism and secular humanists through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So though no one, certainly not then, could really accuse mild-mannered secular humanists as trying to lead some sort of evil revolution, they were mostly academics. You go to a conference, and it's a very, very academic-like conference, but they're accused of pretty much anything and everything you can think of. So they'll create an enemy out of anything if they feel the need to. So as far as what would be causing religious resurgence beyond that, I would look more towards just the general background, economic and political trends for that. And then just, the new atheists are the whipping boy that they latch onto because it's an easy target at the time. If it's not us, it'll be someone else.
Well, I have to imagine, too, that a big part of it is just the aging population. I think that you've probably written about this. I know I have. That studies showing that as a person gets older, their tendency to become believers goes up somewhat. And, this is an aging population that we're facing, a kind of bubble. So that may itself be sort of like part of the reason.
Part of it, although some of the data I've seen shows that the amount of secularism and atheism in any one demographic cohort tends to be relatively stable over time. You don't have lots of people who were atheists when they were 20 and 30 suddenly not being atheists when they're 60 or 70. So it may seem like there's maybe the religion that's there gets a little bit stronger as they get older, but the overall amount, percentage of religiosity in a cohort seems to be pretty much the same, but each successive generation is getting larger and larger and larger. So the young people today who are atheists by the time they're 20, they're probably going to stay atheists when they're 60 or 70.
Yeah, we have to imagine that considering just the trend that we've been noticing how young people are just increasingly less religious, and that some studies were even suggesting that by, 2040 or somewhere around that time, most developed nations may be almost entirely made up of non-believers, or at least that religion plays like no factor. Do you think we're just even beginning to notice that wave? Like, is it even going to be a bigger percentage of non-believers with the next generation to come after that?
Oh, I hate to make predictions, because if something really horrible happens or something really weird happens, the trends could shift quite a bit. And quite honestly, for the vast majority of the population, I suspect that their commitment to either religion or secularism, is probably somewhat thin. I don't want to say superficial, but thin, such that it could be swayed to be a lot stronger or a lot weaker depending on what's going on. I mean, you look at Europe, you still have lots of people on some level have some sort of allegiance or affiliation to a church and to some form of theism, but it's a very, very thin allegiance. They're not committed believers who really, really take it seriously and really go to church regularly and really believe all the things that they're taught. And I suspect you're going to have a similar sort of thing with secular atheists over time because, I mean, just to be fair, most people don't need to bother with any of this stuff in their day-to-day lives. You know, we need to get up and go to work and be there on time and do the stuff there and go grocery shopping and take care of the yard. And there just isn't a lot of time to be thinking about theology and dogma or secularism or secular critiques of religion. So secularism may grow, and it may grow a lot faster than we expect, but I suspect for a lot of people it's going to be a fairly thin secularism, that it's just sort of like it becomes more and more of a default for more people, where they don't really think about it, they don't think about the fact that they don't go to church, they just don't do it. But I wouldn't count on them as being activists in a movement defending church-state separation. That may sound rather pessimistic, but that's just how I've tended to see things over time. Do you know what I mean?
I definitely agree. It'd be kind of like saying, let's all not quit our activism day job, even if there might be a trend that suggests that might happen. Because like you said before, I mean, things could go either way. I'm sure people living in the 1930s in Germany thought everything was going to be hunky-fucking-dory.
Right, right. You never know what's coming around the corner. But, things certainly changed in America after the September 11 attacks, where there was a big resounding outcry of religion and then a secular backlash as well. Things right now would probably be a lot different for the secular community if those attacks hadn't happened. I don't know if it would be better or worse, but it would certainly be different. So if something else equally terrible happens, it could send things going in a slightly different direction. You never know.
It is interesting to think about those linchpins of history, the things that definitely do change. I mean, I hate the 9/11 changed everything, but that it does still apply, just only because it is enough of a catalyst to have made some significant changes in lots of different areas.
Right, right. If it hadn't been for the sort of extreme religion being shown both by the people who made the attacks and by the Christians in America responding to it, we wouldn't have gotten certain so-called new atheist books that wouldn't sort of encourage other new atheist books, and all that together wouldn't have encouraged the activism that we're seeing today. So it wouldn't have happened otherwise. As you said, it certainly changed some things for better and for worse.
You know what I think our biggest enemy is? Apathy. I think that's what we fight, because there's so many people, even some people who listen to my show, or even the people that probably read your articles, there's a certain percentage of them that are always going to be on the edge of caring about it. So there's going to be people who are listening to the show who themselves probably want to start their own blog or probably want to start their version of activism, right? Now, to those people, at least with what your experience and your expertise is, what would be the advice that you would give to those young, prospective new upstarts?
Actually, I have an article somewhere on the site. I can send you a link about, I think it might have even been highlighted recently, about ways to blog more effectively and to write more effectively. But if someone is starting out and wants to be a little bit more active, probably the most important thing that I would suggest is to focus not so much on things that you think interest other people or are important to other people, but the things that you care about most immediately yourself, because you always write better about things that you know and that you care about. If you try and write about things that you don't know so well and aren't as interesting to you, you'll get bored, and your audience will be able to figure that out. So focus on the things that you care about, and then work from there.
There's a huge part of it that just seems to be, you got to work like a dog in terms of producing content, right? People are content hungry.
Yeah. That's another thing. If you want to blog effectively, you need to write effectively, and that means writing well. And there are two things you need to do in order to write well. You write a lot, and second is to read a lot. Writing is one of those things where the only way to improve your skill is to keep at it and to pay attention to how other people are doing it. And when I say read a lot, I don't mean reading things like Twilight or even Harry Potter. I mean, try and read more a bit above your normal reading level. Read things that are a little bit harder and think about how things are being written. And that, over the long term, will improve your writing. And then that will be better all around.
There's a funny story about Hunter S. Thompson, and in order to train himself to be a better writer, he rewrote, I think, The Great Gatsby, just on a typewriter, just to learn more about the style and how it was written. Just what better way than to just rewrite it yourself?
I hadn't heard that, but I certainly believe it. One of the reasons why I write, we were talking about before, is that you learn things when you write about them yourself, as opposed to just reading it passively, but actively rewriting it in your own words and trying to explain it in your own words. It really reveals how much you actually know about the subject and how much your knowledge is failing you. So that writing like that is both good for improving your writing, but also improving your knowledge, showing how much you know and showing what you still need to research. There are lots of times where I've sat down to start writing about something. Oh, yeah, I can write this. I'm not trying to do a dissertation. I'm just giving a basic explanation. But get a couple of paragraphs into it, and I realize I don't know where to go next. I'm missing some key fact. I've got to go back and reread about this to there it is. Okay, these are the key fact or the key facts that I was missing between where I started and where I'm trying to go. I didn't know it as well as I thought I did. You don't get that unless you sit down and try to write it.
I'll tell you, I think the best learning tool I've ever had was being wrong and having that sort of like displayed forever on the internet. Is there no better teacher?
Yeah, it would be nice. I've certainly goofed enough times. I sometimes with just little things like spelling errors. I'm not the best speller. I've got two spell checks that I go put things through, but I still get mistakes creeping in. As I've mentioned before, I'm mostly on my own, so I don't really have someone is able to sit and read everything that I write and edit it. So errors, little ones like spelling errors and sometimes some bigger ones, do manage to creep through. There's no way around it.
I detest myself personally more the times where, I mean, maybe this happens more in radio because it just kind of comes out, but I've said some just terribly embarrassing wrong things, because I suppose a wrong thing sounds better than an awkward silence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally understand where you're going to hit that in radio. I've done that when I had to give lectures. However much I try to prepare in advance, I try to prepare in advance, but then I'll just add something on the spur of the moment. And why did I say that? Get back on topic. Get back to your note cards.
Is there anybody in the scene that you've always wanted to have a conversation with or meet, or like living or dead?
Oh, geez. I mean, there's certainly plenty of people that I have keep reading or have read. Unfortunately, one of my biggest failings is remembering names. People that I work with in an office, it'll be quite a while before I get down everybody's name. And I'm seeing them every day, never mind people that I'm basically just reading their stuff on the internet and not interacting with them. I'd probably enjoy sitting down with P.Z. Myers to talk to, because he's one of those people whose writing tends to be very engaging, just because it's so much of his personality and his opinions are just shining through. In addition to interesting facts and interesting arguments, he's able to hit both at a very high level, more so than most people.
He's also extremely productive.
Yes, he all and Another thing, he's not just putting out one post every couple of days. He's putting out sometimes several posts a day, sometimes several long posts. And that's in addition to his academic work, which I'm sure is not suffering in the background. So the fact that he's able to do so much is definitely something that I look up to.
And so I guess the final questions, the final question before we go, what do you see yourself doing in the scene in the next, like, 10 years? Are you continuing to do this, or is there something else that you'd sort of, like, love to also do? I mean, we're just talking sort of like the ultimate fantasy here. You can just lay it out for me, and then maybe something will happen.
Sorry, in 10 years, I don't always think that far ahead, though. I suppose I probably should. I will hope that I will still be writing, although hopefully I will be writing about more things. I would like to be writing more about wine. I've recently got into wine tasting, trying to do some more wine appreciation. Also photography. I've recently got into using my iPhone to do photography and using some of the photo apps to stylize things, and I've been enjoying that. I actually started both of those a couple of years ago and was starting to do more with it, but then the timeline software came up, and all of my time has been invested in that. I've not been able to do as much writing about wine or photography as I would like. Hopefully in 10 years, that will the timeline, the need to spend all of my time on timelines will have passed.
So this is kind of like your big swan song, if you want to, in sort of like to the atheism scene?
I hope it's not a swan song, but I will be putting, once it's all, you know, semi-over, I mean, I put over in quote in scare quotes because it's, hopefully I'll never be done finding interesting events and dates to add, but once the big push is done early next year, hopefully I can diversify and do some other things, but I will put so much information into it. I do hope that people will be able to use it as a resource to learn more or check up on things that happen with religion during the Crusades and the Holocaust, or to learn more about what atheists in the past have written and have done. This sort of centralized resource doesn't really exist. You know, you can go to Wikipedia and read about things, but it's not focused on these topics that atheists and freethinkers tend to care most about. You've got posts about the history of this person or that person, but just the interactive, organized, directly bringing it all together in one place that doesn't exist anywhere else. And so I hope that it will be useful for that. Just have to get it all done.
Well, it sounds like you've already got a pretty good chunk of it already done. So hopefully everybody's going to – I'm going to put the links for the timeline and for your site in the show notes as well as on the site. I'd like everybody to just go on and bookmark it because I think it's a good idea. I mean, it's sort of like being able to see the history of religion in a way that's at least contextualized. Like sometimes all of these different facts that we have, they can be difficult to remember when there's not a lot of context to them. But I think that through living history, in a sense, we were able to make much more sense of it.
Yeah, I think that even when I was very young, I always had something of a fascination with timelines and chronologies, just seeing different events that happened on the same day, different people were born on the same day. It's like, oh, wow, they might have been separated hundreds of years apart, but it was on the same day. That's neat. Okay, maybe it doesn't have any profound implications for culture and politics. I just found it neat, and that's probably part of what's been driving me to do this, because once I do it, I can look back and say, oh, these happen on the same day. Cool.
Well, I mean, it's something as arbitrary and silly as a person looking up historical dates around their birthday. It's just that we live in days of the week. It's nice to know that other things happen in days similar to ours, because that's what they would have seemed like to everybody else. Just another sunny day or another rainy day like any others that people live through. And I think that in that sense, I mean, what's neat is that we're involved. And, you know, we are somewhat selfish creatures, but that's okay. We like to put things through, you know, the context of us. And I think this is what that does. It's like, well, you live in this world with dates, and then these dates interact with you.
Yeah, it creates a connection.
Exactly. It does create a connection. Well, you know what? With that, I'd like to thank you for coming on the show, Austin, and sharing with us your projects. And all of the stuff that you've been working. Like I said before, you've been at this for a long time. I hope that you don't make yourself a stranger in the scene. I definitely think that there's lots of people out there that are like me that have read your stuff since the very, you know, well, I don't know if it was the beginning, but I know it was way before I fucking started. And I hope that you appreciate, or that people have appreciated you enough and everything that you've done for the scene.
Well, thank you for being a reader, and thank you for inviting me to come on and talk about it. I really appreciate the opportunity.
No problem. Okay, everybody, have a good Atheist Day.